Could you please start by stating your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
Oh, yes. My name is Frank Lee, and today is the 27th of November, 2021, and it is now 8:27 p.m. Eastern Time.
And where are we?
We're in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Great. Thank you so much. And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial, share alike?
Yes.
Would you please start by telling anyone who might find themselves listening to this a little bit about yourself? What do you think they should know about you and the place that you're speaking from?
Oh, okay. I guess I consider myself a young professional, even though I'm middle-aged, in my 40s. And I work in technology, specifically I'm a chip designer. I design chips that go into power supplies and battery chargers. I'm in the process of transitioning fields, learning to become a biologist. Studying biology at a DIY bio makerspace, since there are such things now. And it's really awesome. And my inspiration for doing that is to work on climate change mitigation, which my intuition says biology will be very important. I'm fairly certain that we're going to get the zero carbon grid. I feel that there are many smart people working on that, and that we will absolutely get there, even though it will be hard. But I don't see enough people working on getting rid of all the extra carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere since 1750, since the Industrial Revolution, half of which I believe we've put into the atmosphere actually since 1980. Which is kind of scary. It's like an exponential growth. So that's where I come from. Since I've been a professional, I'm a higher earner than the average person, and that gives me a lot more time flexibility to pursue other things.
Would you start by telling me what the word pandemic has come to mean to you?
Pandemic has been a very hard and stressful place. It's like a prison, but where the bars and the boundaries are not obvious. It's not obvious where the hazards really are, how far we can push things. That's what makes it very stressful. At least in a physical prison, perhaps maybe there are rules and maybe there are walls that you can see, but here there aren't, and that's been very scary for me.
To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, thinking of a pre-pandemic world, what were some of your experiences of health and healthcare infrastructure?
My employer changed because of a merger. A larger company bought us out, and our healthcare immediately became, I would say, a lot worse. We were all put onto essentially what would be considered a catastrophic only insurance coverage. But with the added benefit of something called a health savings account, which is like your 401k, you can save pre-tax dollars into it. And then you can use those pre-tax dollars to pay your own healthcare costs. And then after you've met a certain deductible, then the plan starts paying. But the deductible is extremely high. It was about $3,500. So when I got my first prescription, I was in shock. And when I got my first doctor's bill for $500, I had to pay all of it. And I was quite in shock at that as well. And yet I still have to pay a premium out of every paycheck for this plan. So I'm not exactly sure what we're getting from this, or why the employer switched.
When did the pandemic first hit your radar?
There were some inklings. I had gone to, oh gosh, where was the last place I traveled? I don't remember. But I remember arriving back to Boston by plane and remember seeing signs about that there's some kind of a coronavirus or something that is somewhere else in the world, not here. And that it's not yet a concern, but already I was a little worried. I was thinking, well, maybe this will be like the first SARS, which was also coronavirus, or like that other one, like maybe 10 years ago or so, that I guess is transmitted from camels, that those sort of were present, but they died out by themselves. So I thought that maybe there was a chance for this to happen. And then I heard sometime in December that there were suspicions that this virus could be carried asymptomatically. And I think a part of me sort of knew something was going to go wrong, but I think another part of me sort of blocked that so that I didn't have to deal with that, because it would have been too unthinkable. And then when it happened, I just didn't know what to do. It was just very frightening.
Do you remember what some of your initial reactions were like?
I remember having to go deal with, just a few days before the lockdown here in Massachusetts, I went to deal with an old retirement account from a former employer, and I had been thinking of consolidating all of them into one account. And I remember asking the question after, because there were already news of Wuhan and things like that in China. This was in February. Was this? Yeah, I think it was very late February. Maybe it was early March. I don't remember now. But it was around that time. And I walked into the office. I sat down with the person. You know, there were no pandemic precautions yet. But the markets were very volatile. I'd been watching them. And I asked, can you just move all of the stocks and the whatever, the mutual funds over to consolidate the accounts? Or does this involve selling all of the accounts, taking the cash, and then buying new funds that are substantially the same? And the person said, well, even though it's true that that your account will still be held with us, and the old account is held by us, in the two funds have different things, you know, different securities are allowed. So we will have to liquidate pretty much everything and then repurchase. And I said, and is that done? Like, what is the interval between when you sell and when you buy? It says it might take a few days. That might be happening over a few days. I said, given the choppiness of the market, which was unexpected when you called me and I was agreeing to do this, I no longer agree to do this. And that was, and the person said, oh, okay, I understand. And it was like, thank you very much for considering, blah, blah, blah. And that was one of the experiences that happened very shortly before the lockdown. Yeah, there was also this feeling of dread because I had had hopes of going to visit professors at MIT to learn more about how I might launch myself into a new career or what directions to go into. And then when there was the lockdown, I thought, oh no, I don't know how long this is going to be postponed. And there were also immediately a whole bunch of other issues because I live together with roommates and we all have different families and we all have different significant others and different friends. And so suddenly there became this thing about this not knowing where the dangers are. It became very confusing and very stressful. And it meant that, other people were suspicious of me and I was suspicious of other people. It caused very uncomfortable conversations.
I would love it if you would talk more about living in a situation with roommates at the beginning of the pandemic and then how any of that may have changed.
Oh, so at first we spoke about, we have house meetings about once a month.
How many of you?
Let's see, there are a total of 5 of us here. And we have these house meetings where we try to discuss issues like this, but never had we had something that was as uncomfortable to deal with as this. I have to say that it was difficult to know where everyone else was coming from, and there were subtle issues as to who could be considered reliable and who could not, and things like that that were kind of very scary. Well, part of what at the time we were also very worried that the virus was transmitted through cleanliness and of surfaces or dirty surfaces or contaminated surfaces, and I know that even among doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals who should know better, that washing hands and cleaning things are the most important things to prevent hospital-acquired infections, yet the infection rate is very high in our hospitals. So just knowing that fact and knowing that now it's upon us ordinary people to have to deal with that, I think parts of me just was so anxious that they just shut down. Like I was numb to this because I just couldn't deal with it.
How did situations with the roommates change over time?
There were concerns about some of them. One was was studying to be a school teacher and would be entering classrooms with kids. And another had, a boyfriend. Actually, another, she was polyamorous and had multiple relations in different other households. That suddenly became very scary to me. Just the unknown, the potential unknown size of the bubble there was very difficult. And that's also a situation where you can't wear masks around your partners. Like you can wear masks at work. But yeah, that made it very difficult. And I also live with someone who I love dearly, who is has, you know, she's in her 70s, and I just feel that she's so vulnerable. So I was just very worried. There was just a lot of worry that that I could lose her, or my parents, who are also in their 70s and 80s. I was also worried that I could lose them, because it seemed as if the people who were falling ill and suffering the worst outcomes, at least in Wuhan, they were the older folks. The death rate seems to climb rapidly, like for those who are 75 and older. So I knew that it was disproportionate, and that someone who's young, they likely just get through it as if it were like a flu or something, but they'll do fine, and they might not have as much incentive to be as careful. So that's where I was coming from. And I also felt young, in quotes, even though I'm in my mid-40s, which is really not that young biologically. So I don't feel invincible. But at the same time, it was almost as if I was in the position of someone who was in their 70s, because I'm so connected to the people who I love are in their 70s and 80s. So this made it a very strange situation.
What are some of the ways that you adapted day-to-day living early in the pandemic?
We talked about practical things that we could do. I was able to find face masks for sale at a grocery store nearby that's called Pemberton. For whatever reason, they were the only place nearby, or within, I don't know how far, but we searched a few places, like hardware stores and things like that, and they did not have masks. But Pemberton did, and they charged a very high price for them too. But I was willing to pay it because I thought this is maybe the only protection we had. Also, getting things like hand sanitizer and alcohol were very difficult to find. Like every day I would go to the supermarket and check the section that has the alcohol and the hydrogen peroxide and the bleach. And those shelves were bare day after day. And once in a while, there would be like a couple bottles there, and I would just grab them. And CVS had, our local pharmacy, not local, but anyway, it's a pharmacy. there were these signs that said, yeah, due to supply problems and increased demand, we can't, these items may be out of stock, and also limit like one or two per customer. So also experiencing rationing here in the United States felt a little strange. I don't remember seeing rationing in the US. I've read about it happening in other countries that have communist economies or something like that, but not here in the US.
You had mentioned getting masks at Pemberton. How early did you start mask wearing?
Oh, there was, at first everyone thought that it was surfaces. And so we spent a lot of time cleaning surfaces, especially like the doorknobs here and the banisters. But I saw this YouTube video that was being passed by friends that was from the Czech Republic. And they said that their rate of severe illnesses seemed a lot lower per capita, at least they were claiming that, than other nations around them. And they attributed to the fact that they were making, by hand sewing, these masks and also wearing them and also giving them out for free by leaving them in public places. And also they showed how, well, because my mask, when I wear my mask, it protects you and your mask protects me. Mm-hmm. So that video sort of was going somewhat viral, I think, mm-hmm. at that time. And when I saw that, I said, you know, that makes sense. We should do this. We should get masks of some kind. And so I and another housemate got masks. He had to order, he figured out a way to order them directly from China. I think it might have been AliExpress or one of those services. But those would take months to get here. So we paid extra for the ones here at Pemberton.
2020 was a really big year, as is 2021. Thinking sort of beyond the scope of the pandemic, what have been some of the bigger issues on your mind over the last 2 years?
I'm very worried about our democracy. I'm very worried about how divisive our politics is or has become. I'll admit that I'm one of the ones who, when Barack Obama was elected back in 2008, I thought that we had made a breakthrough as a nation in electing our first Black president. I thought that maybe at the time I saw the colorblind society as the ideal, and thought, oh wow, this is yet another step towards that. We'll have equality. This is yet another sign of that going forward. And then when Trump got elected, but I have to say that where I work, it's mostly men, because I work in engineering. It's mostly white men, and it's mostly older white men. And people are very conservative, and they are very willing to make their views heard. And so I had known that there was this undercurrent, but I assumed that perhaps where I worked was not representative of the American public. And when Trump was elected in 2016, I thought, oh no, this really is a sign. And I suddenly felt like a foreigner, even though I was born here in the United States. I'm more American than some of the white folks here who might have just immigrated, including you. Yes. So I don't
know. The interviewer gestured at herself as an immigrant in the U.S. That's what
I guess my parents are immigrants, but I was born here. So never had I felt like I was a stranger in my own native country. And that was scary. And it did not stop. So in 2020 was a really difficult year, because there was the very strong and present possibility that Trump would be reelected for another 4 years. And also that that the Congress and the Senate would turn more racist and reactionary. And I mean, the result that we got was perhaps not the result that I particularly wanted. I felt that we had swung so far towards there being two Americas, one of the folks like me in the professional class and up, which includes the billionaires and millionaires and so on and so forth. And also, of course, includes a lot of the small business owners and so forth. There were those of us who could, through hard work, succeed. And then there were those folks who, no matter how hard they worked, they could never make it. And I think that we have divided into these two Americas. But what seemed to be happening also was that people were voting perhaps not just based on which America they were in, of these more wealthy and more poor, monetarily poor Americas, but it was also for some reason we were dividing based on race or based on the perceived loss of, for better word, white privilege, that folks who were born, especially white and especially male, felt that they were entitled to a certain ease of life that those of us who are not, both white and male, or white or not male, perhaps, that those of us who are not those things don't experience. Like, I feel fortunate because I'm Chinese, and there's a certain stereotype, I guess, that maybe works both against and in our favor, but at least it's plausible, like, to an employer that, oh, I see, this is an Asian nerd, like, he'll work hard, you know. Or, oh, this is another one of those Asian homebuyers. Yes, okay, maybe, you know, we can give him a loan or something like that. Like, I think we're plausible that way. I'm not sure if I were black what I would experience or how people would look at me as I walked down the street. And that was an awareness that happened during 2020 with George Floyd, when some of us, a large number of us here in the United States, began to read about racism and anti-racism, and about structural racism and the difference between race relations and structural racism, and I started to get a better understanding. Or rather, I would rather say maybe not an understanding, but rather an acceptance that there's the possibility that a black person's experience of the very same spaces that I visit and inhabit every day may be very different than my experiences of those same spaces and those same people. And that's something that I may never, I will never know. And that I should understand that there could be this difference, and to believe people when they say that there is this difference, or to at least accept that it's possible, rather than say, oh, well, they were very nice to me, so they must be that way to everyone. No, maybe it isn't that way. Maybe when I walk down the street, people don't give me a second thought, but maybe if I were a black man, maybe they would look at me in a wary way, or maybe things would happen. I mean, Barack Obama talked about that in one of his later speeches, about the how, as a black man walking down the street, he would hear car doors locking, or women would switch their purses to the other side, the side away from him, or people would cross the street to not have to encounter him. So there were, that sort of planted the seed, but with the protests that we saw over George Floyd and then others, that made it more real. And so so that was one of the issues, is racism, a political divide, and just this sense that it's more difficult now to be able to respectfully disagree, perhaps. Like, there's this sense of danger, almost. Like, if I don't agree with someone and they see that, that I might actually be in danger. There's this sense.
What does health mean to you?
It's a word that we use a lot in my family, almost as a greeting. We wish you good health. And that health is even more important than wealth. So I'll start there. But to me personally, health is, I guess, freedom to, it's, for me, it's tied to freedom. It's freedom to do things. It's freedom to have a body that's capable of doing things that I dream about doing. Maybe that's, you know, I have never really given this much thought. I've always assumed that, oh, there's this thing called health that's fairly obvious what it is, and that when I'm sick, I don't have it. And I treasure it so much when I'm in bed with a fever or violently ill. And then when I have it, I don't think about it because I have it. But for me, it's about having a body that can do, feeling capable of doing all the things that need to be done or that I want to do.
With that idea of what health means in mind, what are some of the things that you want for the health of people around you? And how do you think we can make that possible, a world where that version of health is accessible to people?
My impression, not knowing any real statistics about this, my impression about what afflicts many Americans are cardiovascular illnesses or disease, cardiovascular disease. And I think that might be the biggest killer, which seems to stem there's some theory that it stems from either lack of exercise or poor diet, maybe some combination of both. Dietary advice is so confusing. Or maybe it has something to do with being overweight, but it's hard to say that either. I don't know. I also think that something that's not well addressed in this, in America, but I don't know about elsewhere either, is mental health. And it's not something that we talk about in our family either. There seems to be a great deal of shame over issues in mental health. And I guess I feel I don't have any rational reason to say this, but I get the sense that we're all trapped here in the United States in some loop that we can't get out of, where we wake up in the morning, we're very, very busy all of the time doing something. We have to go to work, or we have to go to school, or we have to do this, we have to do that. And then when we come home, oh, now we have to cook dinner, or now we have to, again, there's like a million things to do, and then it's time for bed. And then you wake up in the morning, it's the same thing over and over again. I'm not sure that that's very healthy. I think that wears on the body over time. I totally get the value of this nation, also a value communicated by my parents, that hard work is how you succeed in life, whatever that means. I don't even know what that means anymore. Because I've been questioning everything. What does it mean to succeed in life if what we've been doing to succeed in life has caused our climate to start to become unlivable? Is that success? I mean, sure, it probably allowed a lot of people to live in mansions and buy yachts or whatever it is that people spend their money on, or go on vacations every day. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't really understand what drives other people. I guess that's what it really is. But I get the sense that we're all spinning our wheels, and that is very unhealthy. I don't think that was actually an answer to your question, actually. because from this perspective, I don't actually see how we can get out of this. It feels like a trap. It feels like we're stuck in this. We're so stuck in this that we don't even know that we're stuck in this.
How did you come to an awareness of this, like, feeling stuck?
Sort of internally, it weighs on me personally, and maybe I make the leap that it affects other people in a similar way. But you're right, it's not very rational. It's not very scientific. I cannot know what other people really feel. I may ask them and they may say things. But I guess that's all that I can ever get. Maybe it's because I feel stuck, because I've gone through this over and over again. I wake up in the morning, I go to work, I come home, I cook, I have to maybe relax some, but then realize that, oh, there are other things I need to do. There are other responsibilities, other obligations, whether to parents or friends. Or sometimes I'm still thinking about work. Sometimes I work very late. So it just made life feel very single dimensioned and not very fulfilling. And I think that is not very healthy. Even if the body stays physically capable, I don't think I could consider myself healthy as long as I was stuck in this loop. And I kind of worry that we all are in some way. I mean, because otherwise we would have enough perspective to look into the future and say, okay, we see that that we are responsible for all this carbon dioxide and other gases that we're putting into the atmosphere that is causing, you know, a lot of changes in the weather patterns, you know, over long periods of time, which then cause, which will cause us great devastation. We should be able to do something about it, like starting now. It should be possible to look forward and to invest and to start a conversation about changes that need to be made. But that doesn't seem to happen. There seems to be a lot of entrenched interest in keeping things the way that they are. They're saying that this is not a problem, even though the science is becoming more and more clear that it is a problem. It only seems to become clearer every year. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. Again, I'm sorry, I seem to have lost the thread. Can you say again what you wanted?
Thinking about the kind of health, the definition of health that you gave, one that looks at sort of freedom, was a word you used a lot in the sort of explanation of health, freedom to do, like access for your body to be able to do things. How do you think we get there so that people can have that kind of freedom? What would have to change?
I don't see a path forward. But I think what would help, even though I don't see how to get there, is if we all could somehow magically have free time, like actual free time, where we can be creative, artistic, and not have to worry about survival, or not have to worry. I don't know how we would achieve that, though, because it looks like we have to spend almost every waking minute of our attention on essentially survival. And I'm not sure how the world got to be this way. Like, one of the things that people notice here in the Somerville, Cambridge, Boston area is that housing is extremely expensive. So your rent might be half of your paycheck. And then gas to commute to work may also be a large fraction. I don't know, a tenth or a fifth of your paycheck. So by the end of it, you don't really have much savings to show for it. And unless you're in a career that can earn you, well, this is 2021, I would say, you know, kind of six-figure-ish, you're walking on this treadmill that's really kind of, you're not making any progress. That's what it seems like. So I don't know how to give everyone all this free time, but I think it would be so valuable if we had it. Because I think if we had it, then we would maybe start to realize some of these other aspects of life that are also important beyond just mere survival. I don't know, I guess I seem to have put things in such dire ways, and I'm sure that people have great joys in their lives too. Um, Yeah, so maybe it's colored by personal experience. I have joys too, but maybe they're in things that might not be easy to explain. I don't know.
May I ask what safety means to you?
Safety means I can more easily picture it than I'm able to explain it.
What does the
Safe
picture look like?
blankets and snuggling under the covers. That for me feels very safe for some reason. Especially doing that under the sun, perhaps. So someplace that's warm to be protected, freedom from worry. Yeah, freedom from worry.
Under COVID-19, there's been a really narrow set of biomedical ideas about safety, thinking within sort of that kind of confined safety from COVID. What are some of the things that you've been doing to try and make yourself feel safe or safer?
One of the things that I do is listening to this podcast that maybe is really more intended for doctors, for clinicians in particular. But it's these 5 or 6 virologists. They get on every week. It's called This Week in Virology. It comes out twice a week. One episode is by a doctor who I believe is fairly high up in the medical system in New York, in the New York City, I guess maybe the tri-state area. I think he's at Northwell and maybe another medical system. But anyway, he gives like the weekly update on COVID. Papers and in particular clinical guidance. And then the other one with the 5 or 6 virologists, that's more about more the science and often they also talk about other viruses besides just this coronavirus. But when they do talk about the coronavirus, it can be quite in-depth. And I really enjoy listening to it. I feel I've gotten a lot from listening to it, sort of being almost takes you to the front lines of what the science is considering, because they will go through preprints, which are not peer reviewed, and because there's 6 of them there, they kind of review it amongst themselves. Like, yeah, I would have liked to see more of, whatever this, but otherwise, this actually looks fairly plausible, so on to help provide some interpretation. And that gives a lot of reassurance. I still do it from week after week.
Is it the access to knowledge that's reassuring?
Yes. And with that knowledge, it has allowed me to make choices. It's allowed me to inform friends and family. Like one friend who had a breakthrough infection. She has a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, I guess COPD. So she finds it hard to breathe and needs to use an inhaler frequently. She got breakthrough COVID. She lives in I wouldn't call it congregate housing, but it's sort of like senior housing that has a lot of shared common space. And a lot of people don't mask, and apparently some people there might be anti-vax or something. Anyway, so she got COVID recently, and I was able to tell her, you can go right now to the emergency room and ask for monoclonal antibodies. Like, you should just do it, like, do it now, because that can really help you. Because they will help if given early. And so basically, by listening to this podcast, I know exactly what to do if I get COVID, if I test positive. I know that back in early September, the FDA gave an authorization for monoclonals to be given to people, even if they don't yet test positive, but they have been exposed to a known case of COVID. So this is the post-exposure prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. So I would do that if I were exposed, like if a contact tracer calls me or someone calls me. There were a couple other things. I know about the vaccines, and I know, yes, they have side effects. Yes, it's but you do need both shots. One shot is not good enough. I know that the J&J does not seem to have the antibody levels, and the efficacy seems slightly lower, but it might still be a good vaccine, and especially now that they let you have a second shot of it, might still be good. Just kind of understanding how it all works just was very, very reassuring. And then now knowing that there are oral antivirals that are coming out, I think that could be a game changer if they work as well as advertised. Although I also just read that one of them really does not work as well as they thought, the Merck one. They thought it's 50% efficacy, but a more careful examination of the data has dropped that to 30% now. So, well, we'll see. I mean, we're still banking on the Pfizer ones. 89%. We'll see what happens.
How have you been keeping in touch with people over the pandemic?
Zoom and calling over the phone. Yeah, mostly Zoom, calling over the phone, Signal, Slack. Discord, yeah, just all sorts of just electronic communication seems to be the major way.
May I ask what it was like hearing that the friend had caught COVID as a breakthrough infection?
Somehow I was not surprised, given what she was saying about some of the neighbors being very careless. I was also very afraid that she could die. But I guess I just told her what I learned, and that was that. And also there's this understanding of medical decisions are to be made by the person themselves for their own body, I guess. So I could tell her about the monoclonals, but once I've told her, it's up to her whether to go get them or not. And that I would respect any decision that she makes. And yet there's also this concern that she might die. So there was that. I was very happy that she went to get them. I was still concerned that she might die. But then the next day she said, wow, I'm already feeling better. And then what ended up being more difficult was the 10 days of quarantine. That was psychologically difficult for her. Yeah, so we would talk on the phone. We would exchange texts and things like that. And I think that helped because she said her other friends seemed to abandon her at this time. So I guess maybe because we're remote, maybe if she were in person, maybe, I don't know, maybe would I have done that? No, I don't think so. But still, I could see why people might abandon you if you have COVID.
This is a bit of an odd question.
Yeah.
Do you remember the last time you had physical contact with a stranger?
Wow, that's a very good question. That's a good one. Yes. A hug from a neighbor when a neighbor is not a stranger, I guess. Do you mean by stranger and actually someone who I actually don't know, or do you mean someone who's not in my bubble, I guess?
I mean, you started with the neighbor, so let's take that as the
okay
place to come from.
Okay. I helped with house sitting a neighbor's house just down the way that way. She was away at a art retreat, and it was January of 2020, and I helped just go feed the cat and just make sure, like, you know, make the place look a little lived in, and spend some time there, you know, reading or doing things like that. So pipes don't freeze and all that. Yeah, and when she got back, you know, we had a really nice hug, and I remember that. Some other neighbors too enjoy hugs because we have this neighborhood brunch. We stopped when the pandemic started. That was very sad, and I really do miss that. Another thing that I really miss is the folk dance scene here. I don't know when I'll be able to do that again. I like something called contra dancing. It's a New England thing where you as a couple dance with other couples and you choose different people to partner with for each dance. And it's almost like a way of hugging, you know, like 20 strangers in succession. It's not really a hug, but you get to dance with them. But I have to admit that I really enjoy that. and a lot of them enjoy looking at you in the eye. And so, you know, I'm shy, but I try to look at them in the eye, or if I can't, then I'll look at their ear or something like that. Oh, I so miss that. Oh, I'm always so much happier when I've gone. That's one of the biggest losses of the pandemic, is not being able to do that. And also this music jam, a group of people that we get together for music jams, we don't get together anymore.
It's been long enough in the pandemic that sort of for those of us who do any kind of celebratory marker, whether they be birthdays or anniversaries or holidays, where we've gone through some of those, could you tell me a bit about how any of those have changed in pre-pandemic/post-pandemic? How sort of celebratory functions look different now?
Oh, Well, I'm a strange case because I don't celebrate very much. I don't even consciously celebrate my own birthday. I treat it like just another day. But now I have to remember to write, you know, my new age instead of my old age. Or my new older age. I don't know. Yes, that's what I mean. Yeah. But no, you're right. Not being able to get in person for celebrations. It feels like it's been so long that, I mean, I'm glad we were able to do the Thanksgiving the other night. I mean, that was amazing. And to know that we could do that with some enhanced safety by doing the rapid tests beforehand was not an option that we had last Thanksgiving. And that was, I guess it means that we can still do these things, but it'll be more inconvenient. But being able to do fun things that involve strangers, that's a much more of a stretch because the issue of trust and agreement is not there. Not to say, as you know, even within families, there is no agreement sometimes as to what is safe. So, yeah, it's this wariness. But also this deep appreciation when we're able to get together. Like us being able to do this interview together. I'm just, and I have to admit that part of what gives me the confidence to do this, to be together and you know, you're not in our bubble and we're not in yours, is because of being vaccinated. I have to admit that that provides a lot of reassurance in some way, even despite what people say about that there are all these breakthrough infections and that we know that the vaccines are not 100%, despite all of that. Yeah. I guess I come at it from the perspective of if I've done the best that I can, at some point, I have to balance avoidance of COVID with mental health issues from isolation. And so if I've gotten the vaccine, and now three times, I believe that I've helped to deal with the COVID risk enough that now the health risk of isolation could actually be more detrimental, more harmful to my health. So that makes me want to see more people and be a little bit more comfortable, knowing that, yes, I could get infected. But also the virology podcast, just knowing now that the virus is in the wild, it's in the wildlife, they're animal reservoirs of this thing. If the virus is now going to pass back and forth between the deer, the mice, you know, cats, dogs, who knows what else, and us. So it's here to stay. And I think it would be very sad if we had to live the rest of our lives in isolation or behind masks all the time. So I'm trying to make a balance of what's healthy in terms of virus exposure versus we seem to have this need to connect socially that also seems to be very important. And I don't know if I've struck the right balance, but the vaccine is helping in that calculation.
How did you come to decide to get vaccinated?
Oh, I read about how the vaccines were developed. And, well, when the pandemic started, my immediate instinct, just based on the kind of general scientific knowledge I have was that, okay, now that we're in this and that this thing has asymptomatic transmission, the only way that we're going to get out of this, and back then, I wasn't certain that this had an animal reservoir, and I don't think the science was yet in. We knew that it probably came from bats, but there was not yet evidence that it was getting into animals here. So I actually had this kind of theory that if we could cooperate as a species and somehow be able to afford for the entire human race like a 6-week shutdown, like anything that's longer than the incubation period, and maybe let's be safe and let's say 3 incubation periods. If we could just have a shutdown and isolation for those 6 weeks and find some way of making sure everyone's taken care of, everyone's fed and so forth, we could beat this thing together. And then the virus will die out. And then we can go back to what we had. I was so hopeful. But of course, also understanding how divisive everything people are, how divided people are, it didn't look like there was any chance in hell that that was going to happen. So the next best thing would be a vaccine. Like I said, okay, it's either we eliminate the virus through a coordinated shutdown, assuming there's no animal reservoir. Otherwise, we need a vaccine. And I thought, oh no, vaccines are tricky because like HIV has been around for decades. It could take decades for us to have a vaccine for this thing. How are we going to deal with this? Like, are we going to have to wear these masks and clean these surfaces from now on? Like, I guess maybe over time, businesses and workplaces and schools will all learn how to adapt. People were talking about UV lights and ceiling fans that would kind of spin slowly but would kind of draw air upward. And the UV lights were these shortwave germicidal UV lights that faced upwards as well, creating a killing zone of ultraviolet radiation near the top of every room. And then the air is constantly being sucked up so that if we all wore masks and we could still all go to school, all go to the office, and this will keep transmission down enough that we could do contact tracing and things like that. Like I thought, maybe we would go there. And then I was amazed when I heard that there was a vaccine already in trials. And when they said that it was a piece of RNA, I was totally not surprised. Like I thought, oh wow, this is exactly what I would have remembered from biology. this is genius. You have your own cells make the viral antigen, which would look to the body like an infected cell. Each cell that was vaccinated would look like an infected cell, thus triggering the immune system to learn from that. And yet this spike protein thing that comes out that's being coded for is harmless. So I think this is genius. Like when this comes out, I want to get me one of those.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
Hopeful, but also nervous, anxious. I guess I'm in a place where I'm almost of the opinion that now that I've had the vaccine 3 times, my next boost will be a natural infection, and that will probably be okay. Or rather, maybe there's a different way to say it. Given my understanding that each and every one of us, because there's an animal reservoir for this thing, this virus is not going away. Within the next few years, each and every one of us in the human race, you know, all 7.9 billion of us, will be infected by this virus, by some variant of this virus. We'll be touched, maybe even multiple times. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. Given that it's inevitable, the only choice that you as an individual can make, or that me as an individual can make, is: do I face this thing vaccinated? And also, do I face it boosted or not boosted? Do I want to wear masks whenever I'm in an indoor space with other people who are not in my quarantine group? So those are the variables that I know how to control, or that I have some say-so over. I don't have say-so over whether other people get vaccinated. I don't have say-so necessarily whether other people wear masks. So I have some confidence that with my next infection and the constant boosting that we'll get, because I believe that each and every one of us will get reinfected multiple times. I think some of them will be symptomatic, some of them will be asymptomatic. Your body will learn to deal with it. And it's gotten a great head start from the three times that you were vaccinated. Because from what I understand how the immune system works, it's a search algorithm. Immune cells, this was explained on the virology podcast, immune cells are unlike other cells in your body. Most cells in your body, they all have the same genome. I mean, except for, there's some slight differences, because obviously a brain cell is different than a skin cell in the sense that it has certain genes turned on, certain genes turned off, and all that. And it's locked into position, you know, that it is going to be a brain cell. If it divides, the daughter cells are going to be brain cells. It has to be that way. If it's not that way, that's what we call cancer. So it kind of has to be that way. But at the genetic level, immune cells have a portion of the genome that on purposely hypermutates. And what the immune system is trying to do with this hypermutation is to create variation in antibodies and variation in, I guess, T-cell receptors. So it does that, and then it tests those against its own cells, like self cells. And if there's a reaction to self, those immune cells die. Like they don't make it. But if there's no reaction to self, then now it becomes an adult, like a more mature immune cell. Now it's kind of ready to kind of take its place in the army, so to speak. And antibodies are circulating. It might circulate a very small amount, or if it's a T cell, it's kind of, you know, going through your bloodstream or your lymphatic system looking. And if it ever recognizes something, then because it's already been trained on self, the fact that it recognizes something is with very high probability is non-self. So then it starts sending these signals like, hey, I found something, which then draws the rest of the immune system in, which then causes it. Now it has the set of the genetic code needed to make the molecule that can recognize this foreign thing. It now is in a privileged position and is given the resources to divide. And when it divides, those daughter cells will carry a genetic sequence that's very similar, but it's also slightly shuffled around a little bit, so that now it's going to, it'll have a very similar shape to its parent cell, but it'll be slightly different. So and then if any of those also recognize, or recognize even better, the whatever the foreign thing is, then they get into that privileged position of being able to mutate and to divide. So it's the immune system is searching for better and better recognition molecules or recognition motifs for these foreign things. And what the vaccine has given is part of when you're sick is your body needs to spend a lot of time in this process searching for the right shape of antibody and T cell receptor to attack either the virus or the disease cells. And the vaccine gives you such a head start to that. It gives you a head start in an environment that's safe, where the body's not under any actual harm. And so you've already done some of the work. You're like maybe 5 days or weeks ahead of where you need to be. When that coronavirus comes in, you will very likely have multiple diverse antibodies that will recognize different parts of the virus and also different proteins that are expressed by infected cells. And it will be a very quick and decisive victory for your immune system. And then those infected cells are taken apart, the virus is taken apart, those proteins go into essentially what's like schools for young immune cells. And they learn again, they are tested against them. And so every time you get infected, the breadth and depth of antibodies and T cell receptors expands greatly. So this is why they say that even though the third shot is the exact same thing as the first and second shot, you'll get better immunity. And it's because the repeated exposure causes the immune system to realize, oh, wait, maybe I should invest some more resources in this thing. I seem to be seeing this thing a lot, like very often. Maybe it's not just a one-time thing. Maybe I should invest a little bit more. So that seems to be my layperson's understanding from listening to that virology podcast. So I just feel, oh, okay, so maybe I'm in a spot where I can now be repeatedly naturally infected. And yeah, sometimes I might get, you know, a flu or something like that, but we'll probably be fine. But there's also this sense of the chance of not knowing and the chance that I live with someone who I love dearly, and my parents who are in their 70s, and that it's understood that the vaccine does not work as well in that age group. And so that part still is very worrisome. I don't know. It's like after my parents and, the person I'm living with have gotten their breakthrough infections and survived it, then maybe I'll feel better. Maybe that's what I'm waiting for. I don't know.
What are some of your hopes for a longer-term future?
I guess I still have this hope. I was hoping that this coronavirus would end up being a practice run for all 7.9 billion of us to learn to work together to solve towards a common goal, that we could learn to cooperate and we could beat this thing. Because this is easy compared to the other disaster that we're facing, which is the climate crisis, which is a lot harder to face. I felt that if we could somehow learn to cooperate to deal with the pandemic, that would help set up the type of trust and infrastructure that would allow us to then deal with the much larger issue of the climate crisis. And so far, that does not seem to be happening. Also, I guess maybe this is a glass half full, glass half empty moment. Like maybe this is more, maybe I should be more optimistic than I'm feeling. Because, I mean, who knew that we could find a vaccine in less than a year of encountering an unknown virus? And I sort of understand the concept of the U.S. and the European countries, you know, the whole concept of putting on your own oxygen mask first before helping the person next to you if they need help. So I get that, and I hope that we get to that point quickly where we there is equity in vaccine access, because I think that could be that could still be a big thing, even though it seems like it's looking less likely.
What are some of the ways that you've been taking care of yourself over the course of the pandemic?
I've been taking naps. Naps seem to be very important. I'm also understanding about the nature of... I guess I'm a very driven person. And I'm learning that there's value in slowing down. That maybe what I see as productivity may not be as productive as I think it is. Maybe it's just being busy. Because I guess I feel I'm a product of this very civilization that has produced this crisis of the climate crisis. And this crisis was produced by all these people being so driven and being successful and working hard. So it's put me into a place where I don't know what values are truly meaningful. It's made me question a lot of things. Seeing the school strikes, and now I guess seeing workers have worker power even though they are not unionized is quite heartening. And I guess how I take care of myself is sometimes I escape. And for some people, escape is maybe have a few beers or have a glass of wine or smoke, you know, something, or play video games. I used to play video games. But what I really enjoy is reading about science or thinking about science, or trying to solve some math problem, or tinkering with electronic circuits, or now learning biology, learning how to grow things. There's just so much, there's such a wealth of, it's like a communing with nature. I know it sounds very strange to say that I'm communing with nature while I'm in a lab, but I see that all the things around me in that lab, even though they're made by humans, I see them as parts of the natural world. They're still made of stuff from the natural world, which behaves in the way that it behaves, not necessarily in the way that we want it to behave or that we think it should behave. It doesn't follow our theories. Our theories are meant to help us understand, you know, how they function, but they may or may not actually be functioning that way. And it always feels like a communion, like a conversation. Being in the lab with a chip that I allegedly designed, yeah, sure, I it was a concept in my mind. You know, I laid out the architecture, I fleshed out the where the transistors should go and what the sizes are and all that. And I have a theory about how that's driving how I'm doing this. But at the end of the day, that piece of silicon in front of me is its own thing. It's a piece of nature. It's a piece of the natural world. It does what it does. If what it does happens to also match what we intended it to do, then we can ship it as a product. But it most likely does not. And sometimes how we address this at our company, when we realize that it will be very expensive to change it, to do what we said that we wanted it to do, is to actually change the specification to what it actually does. So, but anyway, I always feel like I'm in a conversation with nature when I am evaluating one of my chips in the lab, or even looking at a piece of code, even though that's a piece of mathematics, essentially. It still behaves in the way that it behaves, and you have to be humble and be willing to listen to see what it's trying to tell you. So I never feel like I'm alone when I'm in the lab, because I feel like I'm like nature's right there with me. But nature speaks a very unusual language. It can be very inscrutable, confusing, but also amazing, sublime. That's what drives me forward. I can come home very late from the lab or from work and say, wow, that was an amazing day. Yeah, it didn't work. It didn't work the way that I thought. But I think I learned something that was quite not what I expected and quite remarkable. It was an interesting conversation. Anyway.
So we know we're in this moment where there is all of this scientific and biomedical research happening around us related to COVID-19.
Yes.
I'm wondering what you think people in the humanities and the social sciences can be doing right now to help us understand this moment.
Oh, I think there's a huge role. I think even if we didn't have a vaccine and we didn't have all this biomedical research, that if we were a simpler civilization, we could still deal with this. If we had a sense of unity and a sense of, I guess, humility, to not think that we know more than we do. And to the extent that we're not doing those things, I think those issues are issues that are very deeply rooted, not in the sciences of, I guess, the biology or the chemistry or the biochemistry of the disease, or the virus. It's really about us and how we as humans make decisions, why we choose what we choose, why we believe what we believe, why we tell ourselves the stories we tell ourselves. Because it's those stories that then drive how we choose to act. So I think there's something there, and I wish I knew what that was, because I also feel that climate change will be dealt with the same way. I think we could solve climate change in 10 years if we were willing to cooperate. I think it's possible. And I think we could be dealing with the pandemic the same way, even if we didn't have this technology of the mRNA vaccines and the antivirals and all that. Maybe we would, I mean, we may have solutions that would be very different or have outcomes that would be, that might seem very different than what in our current framing would be considered a success. Like if success is eliminating the virus or eliminating, wiping it off the face of the earth, that's not what we would achieve, or that no one would ever get sick. I don't think that's what we would achieve either. And that's not what we could achieve with our technology. But I think we would reconceptualize when someone is sick, how the society cares for them. And when someone is dying, how do we interpret that? So, you know, my partner Harriet and I, we started reading this book called The Five Invitations. It's by a Buddhist a teacher who's also works in hospice care. And it's quite, I mean, it feels very foreign to me because I'm not used to thinking that way. But it seems to make a lot of sense what he says. And I want to spend more time thinking about that. Because that's a completely different way to address, to face these challenges that we face now. It would solve things, but maybe we in our current framing we might not see them as solutions. Meaning that like people might die of the illness. But perhaps they would be, I don't know, maybe they wouldn't just be, seemingly forgotten or just be another number in some graph somewhere. But we would kind of experience, I don't know, because I guess I'm too rooted in the sciences to really understand this. Maybe the closest thing I can say is an experience with my father who's losing his memory. It has been a great test for me because one of the things that they've taught me is that it's very important to be useful. When you're young, you work hard. You save for the future. You protect your children. You save so that your children will have a better life. You're there to provide. Nowhere does this philosophy seem to address what happens when you become disabled yourself? And now you're potentially a burden to others. So, with his memory loss, I can tell that it is quite wearing on my mom. My mom is able to deal with it, it seems. But her hair turned from still being fairly dark to completely white just in the course of a few years of dealing with this. And I had an experience when I went home where I was in bed. It was at night. I woke up and he was adjusting my blankets. And I immediately felt annoyed because I guess we have this father-son pattern where he kind of treats me like a baby and, you know, as if I were not competent or capable of taking care of myself and that he has to do everything for me. And then he left, and then like 5 minutes later, he came in again and adjusted the blankets. And then like 5 minutes later, he came in again and he adjusted the blankets. And then I'm realizing what's happening now. It's a short-term memory issue. He doesn't know that he's already done it. And then I realized that, wait, I can keep being annoyed by this, but there's also another way to see this. Maybe the memory is gone, but the soul is still there, and that's his love coming through. And I was greatly at peace with that and fell asleep. So, kind of a realization that there has to be more to a person than just how useful or how much they can contribute. Because, I mean, at some point, we're all going to face some type of disability. And is that all we are? Or just cogs in a machine? You know, if we're not useful, you throw them away. Is that what this is? There has to be something more. And I think I got a glimpse of that through my father. So that's where I feel that the method of what people in the arts, people in the liberal arts can do could be extremely powerful, maybe even more powerful than what we technologists and scientists can do.
I'd like to ask you to imagine talking to some historian in the future, someone who was not alive during this moment of the pandemic, so who has no lived experience of it. And if that historian asked you what kinds of stories need to be written about this moment, about the pandemic, what kinds of things would you tell them have to be remembered that are important for the next generations to understand about now?
I think sometimes something happens that makes what we're doing seem absurd. And maybe this pandemic is one of those things. Maybe climate change will be the next thing, or the other thing. I see it has caused some people to radically change direction in their lives. I guess I am too, looking into biology, but also all the worker strikes, all the people quitting, some people walking out of their shifts even, of working at a restaurant, for example. I think once in a while, there needs to be a great reset. And I think maybe that there's a story there of kind of waking us up perhaps from this pattern that we'd settled ourselves into, which sort of worked, seems to work for some people, it doesn't work so well for other people. I think a poverty trap is a very real thing right now. I think people are wakening up to that. They see that they're stuck in these shitty jobs. They'll never be able to get out of out of the debt or poverty because rent is so high or the mortgage is so expensive and the things that they need to live are so expensive. The essentials are expensive. Healthcare is expensive. Education is expensive. I don't know what story to tell personally. Yeah, but I think it would be in that direction of looking at people who have completely or who have made radical change in how they live their lives. Because I think that there are probably many of us.
I want to thank you so much for everything that you have shared with me today. And at this point, those are all of the questions I have, but I'd just like to open some space that if there's anything you want to say about the experience of the pandemic that my questions haven't facilitated the chance to say to make that available to you now.
Ah, okay. I think I've said everything that's within me to say. I think so. This is just a very confusing moment in time. There does not seem to be a map as to what to do. I thought I had one. And then suddenly, it's like all the foundations are all gone. It feels... I don't want to say... because that would be too negative, and that's not what I feel. It's just such a radical change that I don't think that we who are living in it actually understand how radical this pandemic has created this opening for such radical change. There are powerful forces that want to keep things the same way. And the people who are in high positions have a lot of power to try to keep things the same way. But at some point, they're going to need the cooperation of the majority of us who do not enjoy those privileges. And this was something that I learned when we were, and I guess we still are, but it doesn't seem as imminent a threat. There was this sense when after the November election in 2020 that Donald Trump would lead a coup, or his supporters would lead a coup. There was that very real possibility, and as we saw, there was actually, an invasion of our capital on January 6th. To prevent certification of the election results. And um, I attended a workshop on how to stop a coup. And one of the things that was mentioned about how coups have to happen very quickly, and they need the cooperation of a lot of the people. And for example, if business leaders did not go along with it, or if religious leaders or community leaders did not go along with it, it would fail. Like, because a government needs administrators, needs people to enforce the laws, needs people to you know, keep records. And if those people suddenly had a strike, the coup would not last. So the power, in some sense, does come from us, but there are still people who have more resources to make change than others. Because I guess here in the United States, we have a Supreme Court decision that says that corporations are essentially people with respect to the Constitution and have a right of free speech, and that money is speech. So now, if you're a corporation, you can, you have unlimited ability to influence elections. And I think that that's, we're going to see the struggle play out. I see signs of hope in that people are quitting those shitty dead-end jobs, and that people who are employers who are trying to hire people for those shitty dead-end jobs are now having to increase wages, having to give benefits. Maybe we'll learn to respect people as people rather than based on what they do for work. And I think that, I mean, I don't think we'll actually get there in my lifetime, but like, this is like a slight change in that direction. Like, maybe over 1,000 years, if we survive that long, maybe we'll learn to value one another, not for based on what we do for work, but just for being human, for our self-expression. I just wish I knew how we could get there, because I would like to live in that world rather than this one. But still, I see that possibility, and it does give me hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.